Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee for Tuesday, March 20th. Clerk, we'll call the roll.
Representative Szymanski.
Present.
Representative Mazerall.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion. Representative Cornish. Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Kreisel. Representative Lane. Representative Lesch. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Schumacher. Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Swazinski. Representative Vogel.
Here.
Representative Wardlow.
Okay. Quorum is present. Would someone like to move the minutes of the previous meeting? Representative Anderson?
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any discussion to the minutes of the previous meeting? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Okay. Representative Grunhagen, would you like to move House File 2232?
Yes.
All right.
288. I think the HHS.
Yes. All right. Representative Grunhagen moves House File 2232 be recommended to pass and send to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Welcome, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr.
Please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 2232 is a bill that aims to guarantee that we have the level of integrity that we need to have in our various state welfare programs. This bill, I actually began designing members back in the late summer, fall of last year when I had a constituent come to me and talk about the perplexing observations that he saw about people who had multiple driver's licenses with certainly the same photo on them. So I met at that point with Chair Cornish and some other members, and also Ms. McCormick from the Department of Public Safety, and recognized they were going through a facial recognition software scrub of their database. And what this bill does is it does three things. It's got three components. One is that it takes it allows the Department of Human Services to access the data about the people who have been scrubbed, if you will, from that database and identified as fraudulent IDs, and lines them up against the Department of Human Services 800,000 different welfare subscribers, and identifies people who potentially may be signed up for a welfare program illegally or improperly. And then the department goes through their rigorous due process, and upon proving with certainty that people are signed up improperly or illegally, terminates their subscription to the different programs. So that's one. The second is, Ms. McCormick is here from the Department of Public Safety, if members have questions of her. But the other one is the ability to identify legal presence. And the Department of Public Safety has the ability for people who are visiting here, who have short-term or temporary driver's licenses, and the ability to identify the time at which those driver's licenses expire according to their visas or their temporary residency cards. So what will happen is the Department of Human Services will also have the ability to access that data and then be able to compare that against their welfare databases and identify people who, again, may be illegally or improperly signed up at that time. The third component, members, is I was working on another bill in the interim and recognized that we have sections in statute that carry along consequences for people who are convicted drug felons who may be signed up for MFIP or general assistance programs. And those consequences include periodic drug testing. And so I asked the department at the time how many people were identified to be in conflict with this part of statute, and the number came back. There were 82 throughout Minnesota who were largely people who self-identified when they signed up for the welfare program in the first place. Asked them if they had actually checked with the court's database to identify people who had been signed up for or who had been convicted drug felons who were signed up for these two programs, and they had not. So the third thing this bill aims to do is to similarly ask the Department of Human Services to access the court's data for convicted drug felonies, and then again compare that against the MFIP and GA databases, and finding people who are of convicted drug felonies, actually requiring them then to subscribe to the existing statute that directs the department's actions in those two program areas. So that concludes my comments, Mr. Chair. We have Ms. McCormick and Mr. Kerber from the Department of Human Services, if you'd like to hear from them.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Grunhagen, we have an amendment to the House file, 2232.
A5 amendment.
All right. Representative Grunhagen moves the A5-1 amendment to House file 2232. Any discussion to the amendment? If not, we will proceed to vote on the amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. All right. Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair,
please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me. Representative Johnson.
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, what does the amendment do? Could we just get some clarification how it changes the bill before the testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. Several things, most of them could be looked at as minor. Line 1.2 changes the word person to individual, and then refers back to the sampling of data from the Department of Human Services to the courts, and said they will go back and look at data from the previous 6 months, and that was the agreement that the department had with the courts as they sample that data. 1.4, we basically, it was an oversight, left out 256D, which is a general assistance statute. It was intended to have both of those covered, and we just had the MFIP reference originally in the language. 1.6 through 1.7, kind of that area, looks at changing it from assessing the need according to current statutes that basically suggests that they should proceed according to the law. In other words, read what the law says and use the current law in that situation. Lastly, changes the effective date of the bill. Actually, the report to April, to give the effective date of the bill, if I remember correctly, is January 1st. So we move the effective date of the report to April, so it gives the departments more time to report.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Johnson, any further questions on that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, the House summary remains the same of what the bill's intent and what the bill does.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Sorry for the interruption. Mr. Kerber, please proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, where I'm the head of the new Inspector General's Office. And I'm really mainly here to answer questions, but I will just say that the department is in support of this bill and is kind of excited about this opportunity. This is not a bill that changes eligibility requirements or changes the process for determining that eligibility, but rather what it's doing is it's using existing databases that the state has to verify whether the information people gave us was accurate and continues to be accurate. And so this is the kind of program integrity operation that we're looking forward to doing more of within the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Kerber, so is this process all pretty invisible to the applicant or to the person who's on the program?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, yes, it will be. You know, we're going to take a look at the notices that we're giving people. certainly at the time that they're enrolling, to make sure that they're including the information, you know, including information that will be verifying the, you know, the answers they give to questions. But it will be it will be invisible to virtually anybody except at the department. And then when we get something, you know, then we'll be sending it out to the appropriate investigator. We have some investigators who follow up on any kind of report that there may be fraudulent activity. And so if there's an identity fraud issue or an expiration of somebody's legal presence status, then that would be investigated at the local level by our partners out there in the fraud prevention investigation program. The other part, where we get information about new felony drug convictions, that isn't an automatic disqualification either. That kind of kicks into whatever the standards are, and there are some varying standards depending on the program somebody's in. But then that sort of kicks into whether or not the people knew about that at the time of enrollment, and whether or not they have exercised that drug testing provision that's already in law.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerber, so right now people are asked about felony drug convictions, and then this new procedure will help verify that. So I'm wondering, if we're going to do this through a database, does it make sense to be asking in the first instance? And is there any sort of, you know, I know that we're asking about felonies that go back a ways, too. So if somebody doesn't report and then it's found that they have one, other than being under the restrictions that go along with having the felony, is there any sort of penalty for not reporting it?
Mr. Kerber.
Assuming they're still eligible.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm not aware that there's a penalty for providing false information or making a mistake. I think generally there's some leniency there. Sometimes people aren't sure whether they have a felony. Sometimes they think that there was a stay of imposition or... and they're not quite sure what it is. And so I think, you know, my own experience dealing with people with criminal records, they don't always know. And so there's no new penalty here that's being imposed. I think what this is going to do is after we get this new system fired up, we're going to be kind of experiencing some new issues. And I think we'll have to take a look at what are the consequences of this and the other laws that are in place. I mean, there's some variation in how... for instance, the drug conviction plays a role, whether you're in general assistance or whether you're an MFIP. And so there's, you know, we've had some discussions already about maybe those things should be standardized, but we're going to kind of take a look at this and see what happens for next year.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Well, yeah, that was really my point, not that anybody's purposely anything, just that people often don't know, or I think it makes a lot more sense to me to do it this way than to ask people to self-report, just because of that variation in what people remember, whether the person doing the filling out the forms with them is asking them the right way or whatever. It makes a lot more sense to me to do it this way, in a way that's more seamless and more uniform and not intrusive for the person who's making the application, maybe even less intimidating for them. So thank you.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, one comment on that, just so people are clear. This isn't really completely bulletproof, really, because it's not a background study process. And so it's not that at the time of enrollment there's a background study being done to see if what they gave is accurate. What this is doing is just verifying periodically that the people currently enrolled, whether or not they have this type of conviction. And as you can see here, what we're doing is there's one big data comparison that we hopefully will get from the court system, and then compare it against our database. But then we'll get updates every 6 months. And so the flaw with that, of course, is that if somebody enrolls today, or enrolls after we've done a check, and their conviction is for more than six months ago, you know, we're not necessarily going to catch that, because we're not checking everybody's criminal record all the time. But it's getting closer to that. So it doesn't completely replace, I guess what I'm trying to say, it doesn't completely replace that self-reporting component. But I think what it's going to do is to help us answer the question about should we do a kind of a behind-the-scenes background study at the time of enrollment that doesn't cost the individual anything, maybe, or somehow we'll figure out how to do that. But it's a good point that, you know, whether we should require somebody to self-disclose something or just check it is, I think, something we'll be looking at. And hopefully we'll report on that, some experience next year.
All right, next we have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, I see there's a lot of data sharing going back and forth. Will this be going to civil law to look at that issue of confidentiality of data and the like?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson. Yeah, as a matter of fact, Representative Abler has identical language in his omnibus bill, and that did go before civil law, and actually there were adjustments made to the approach which are reflected in the bill according to the Data Practices Subcommittee of the Civil Law Committee in an effort to maintain data security. So actually changed the approach to a data sampling that the department will do rather than the department maintaining their own full database, which was something that the committee would have liked to have seen, and so that was incorporated into the bill.
Representative Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the sense of the same bill as in Abler's bill?
Representative.
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, correct.
Okay.
Representative Johnson.
When I look at Section 4 and it talks about implementation of Sections 1 through 3, does that mean that the program that you're talking about won't be implemented till we find out what the cost is?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. Actually, Representative, the amendment actually stamped an effective date for the entire bill as of January 1st of 2013. The point that you pointed to in the bill talks about when the report will be due. So there will be what is effectively 3 months or 4 months for the implementation of Sections 1 through 3 to take place, and then the reporting will happen at that point to the legislature.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I see in terms of cost, the court of, state court administrator isn't mentioned as far as providing some kind of fiscal impact, but yet looks like they're doing some work. Any reason they shouldn't be required to give some idea of what it's going to cost them?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, I understand a fiscal note is forthcoming, and actually Mr. Kerber's been involved in that process. Maybe he can discuss it.
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, my understanding is that a fiscal note has been requested from the court system, and they are working on it, and the Department of Human Services also has a fiscal note. One of the things that we'll be figuring out as at the next step here is whether our assumptions are jiving here, because some of the things that have to be done are some programming with the court system's records, and we'll get clear with them as to who's going to do the programming. Is it programming that's on the human services end, or is it programming on the court service end? They have a number of different subscriptions that you can subscribe to MNSIS records in a pretty neat fashion. However, as my understanding of it is that you might get more information than you're really interested in getting through the data sharing agreement, and so it would be our responsibility on our end to put those filters on. That in this case, we don't want all court record information. We want only convictions related to felony level drugs under 152. And so if it's anything but that, we're not going to be interested. And so then is it a matter of our doing that programming to filter out that information so we don't get it, or is it the courts? And so that's one of the things we're just going to have to work out here.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a problem that comes up with some regularity is passing bills out of this committee, Judiciary Finance, where we don't have a fiscal impact on what it does to the courts. And as we all know around this table, the courts are drastically underfunded, and any little additional cut is an additional wound to the judicial system. And I'm really reticent about passing anything out of here without actually knowing what the costs to the courts are. I think that's a significant problem that we have here, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the agencies are here supporting this bill, so does that mean that this is something the governor supports as well? Have you had those conversations?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, you know, there is a tricky issue with the fiscal note here, but the concept is certainly something that we're very much in favor of with this administration. This is not in the governor's budget, but what we're hoping is that through the fiscal note process, we're going to be able to show this budget neutral, and so that there really won't be an issue. But the concept, absolutely, yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like someone else is coming down on that question.
Good morning.
Morning,
Representative Hillstrom, did you want to readdress your question, or should we just proceed with this reply?
I think she knows the question.
Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. The Department of Public Safety has not taken a position on this bill. We have worked with Representative Druskowski to make sure that we can administer this bill if it would be enacted into law, but we haven't taken a position on the bill.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have other questions. So, Representative Druskowski, one of the things I prosecute is welfare fraud. So, in the event that you find people who were ineligible by this database, I anticipate they will be sent to the investigators and then they will be sent up for prosecution and for the money to be returned. So have you had conversations with the county about what their anticipated cost would be for the additional enforcement? Because ultimately, if someone receives benefits that they were not entitled to, and they knowingly provided false information on the application, it is a felony. And ultimately, then there are limits then on when they can get benefits in the future. So have you had those conversations with those allies?
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hillstrom. I have not, Representative, talked directly to the county attorneys or their association about this, but would just point out simply we don't require anything of the county attorney in the bill, but we simply send the information to them for them to decide whether and how they want to act on that particular information.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if someone's committed a crime, there will be additional prosecutions. And there will be additional court costs, because ultimately, if people lie on the application, knowingly file false applications, and they are given benefits that they are not entitled to, folks will be prosecuting them.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess we will see what comes out. We don't know exactly how the county attorneys will handle this. I suspect there will be variability depending on their workload. Etc. But I would also suspect that and hope that overall we're going to see a bill here that is going to have a positive fiscal impact on the state of Minnesota.
Representative Cornish.
I guess for Representative Hillstrom, and I really don't know the answer to this question, but it would be interesting. I've dealt that very few of those are prosecuted. It's the choice of the prosecutor to prosecute them, and I think that financial officers probably give warnings and don't even turn them in for prosecution, a lot of stuff. And then it's an argument whether it was a mistake or something intentional. So I just bet you that there's quite a percentage of these violations that are found that don't ever get prosecuted. And even when they're turned over, that the prosecutor probably just neglects to prosecute them for lack of proof or conflicting stories. So it'd be interesting to see what the fiscal impact would be.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Cornish, you take a bit of exception with that. I have three of those cases right now, and I can tell you as a prosecutor, I'm not doing one thing differently than I would do with any other person that committed a felony. So, Representative Cornish, I think that if you want some data on that, maybe we could ask if there's any out there. But if someone lies on their application and they knew they lied when they filled it out and they got benefits they were not entitled to, they have committed a felony, and I think those are prosecuted at the same extent other felonies are prosecuted in this state.
Representative Cornish.
For the ones that make it to you that you ever hear about, yes.
All right. Is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against House File 2232? All right. Seeing none, Representative Grunhagen renews his motion that House File 2232, as amended, be passed and sent to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
Motion passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
You're welcome. Representative Drazkowski. Okay. Representative Smith. The next bill on our calendar for today is Representative Smith presenting House File 876. Good morning, Representative Smith. Would you like to move your bill?
Morning, Mr. Chairman and Committee. Yes, I'd like to move House File 876 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
All right. Thank you, Representative Smith. Please proceed with your bill.
Mr. Chairman, I believe a week ago we had this bill in front of the committee and we presented it and we're in the midst of taking testimony. This, I will remind the committee that this bill in maybe slightly different form did pass judiciary last year and was included in the omnibus bill but was deleted in conference. The thrust of the bill is that since 1986 delinquency hearings have been fairly open. This bill would attempt to pull back from that a bit and forbid the public from delinquency hearings unless the court determines that due to the violent level or seriousness of the charge that the public has the right to know. I do have a testifier somewhere.
Okay. While the testifier is approaching, Representative Smith, I believe we were also working off a DE-1-2 amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that was adopted on March 13th.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. All right. Welcome to our committee. And please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Sarah Walker. I'm the COO at 180 Degrees that serves about 2,000 juveniles who are involved in the justice system. And I'm also a founding member of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition. Thank you so much for having me. I guess I just mainly, I know you heard this bill last week, and for the sake of time, I'd just like to offer a few clarifying points as follow-up from the testimony you heard last week. There were two issues raised. The first was on expungement. And the issue of expungement came up as a remedy for youth who ended up with records. Representative Lesh, I believe, clarified that the current state of juvenile expungement law is far from settled. Judges have interpreted the law in different ways, often not sealing records, and a recent Court of Appeals case on this issue that would have provided a better remedy has been appealed to the Supreme Court. Even if the law becomes more settled and a better remedy is created by the courts, by the time a juvenile can get an expungement, if they can pay an attorney to represent them or find someone to do it for free, it will be too late. Data collection companies who will have harvested the public data in the meantime will still have that information and are not subject to an expungement order. Opportunities will have already been missed in a young person's most formative years. The issue of geographic disparities was also raised. The truth is that these disparities already exist, and that they're just in different parts of the system. Before the judge often sees the case, schools differ, for example, in how they refer behavior cases to the police. Police differ in how they refer matters to be prosecuted, and prosecutors differ in what they charge. For example, one county's disorderly conduct charge might be another county's felony terroristic threat. These disparities often translate to racial disparities we see. Minnesota's Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee's 2011 report noted that 26.6% of all of the Minnesota's juvenile cases represent racial or ethnic minority groups. But youth from racial and ethnic minority groups constitute 50% of delinquent findings in cases where the race is known. This legislation will not increase these disparities. It will help prevent these disparities from further translating into lost opportunities and further increasing the disproportionate impact on communities of color. It will help alleviate some of the disparities we already see in education, employment, and housing. And I'd just like to remind you that this is actually, you know, has tremendous bipartisan support and is really represented by a broad group. House File 876 is part of the legislative agenda of both the Minnesota Corrections Association, the Council on Crime and Justice, the 65 organizations that make up the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, and it's supported by the Minnesota Association of Community Correction Act Counties, the Minnesota Association of Community Probation Officers, and the Minnesota Juvenile Detention Association. And I believe we have one more person to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Smith, do you have another testifier?
I believe we do, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jackie Nichols. I am a juvenile probation officer, and I'm here to represent MCA's Juvenile Justice Committee. As a probation officer working with juveniles for 15 years, it is my job to hold the juvenile accountable for their behavior, to compensate the victim, and to compensate the community for any losses. At times, I place juveniles in out-of-home placement, increase their skills, provide therapeutic interventions. Ultimately, my job is, as a probation officer, is to reduce their risk by providing these targeted interventions in preparation of the future as an adult. Once a juvenile successfully completes their probation, I see them off, 16, 17-year-olds, they move on from their mistakes with the intention of having a bright future, a pro-social future. The frustration for me comes when I get calls, sometimes 2 years later, from juveniles I work with on probation. I get many calls, but the message is consistent. The juveniles are often shocked, angry, and discouraged because their juvenile record has prohibited them from moving on with their life in the form of a job, housing, or education. The message is often this, that they feel that they're punished for something that they did as a kid. They say, I thought I moved past that. I did everything that I was supposed to when I was on probation. And I did something dumb when I was a juvenile. They explain they haven't been in trouble since, and they don't understand why this is happening. The problem with these public records is that it provides research-based barriers to the unemployment or to employment, education, and housing. So the result is what is contrary to the rehabilitative intention of the juvenile justice system. The research indicates that anytime there are barriers to these employment, higher education, and housing, the risk of public safety is actually increased because they predict future criminal behavior. And in summary, my job is to reduce the risk to public safety. The problem with this public records for 16 and 17-year-olds is that it actually increases the risk to public safety. And if I may just provide one or two examples of clients I've directly worked with. Heather was 16. She was charged with possessing drugs. At the time, she was in a relationship with a young man who was not a good influence. He had gang associates and was surrounded by negative peers. Heather got pregnant in the beginning of probation, and she was court ordered to do a number of things, including CD treatments, work with a therapist, submit to drug testing. She did more than enough community work service, more than the amount of community work service the judge ordered. Heather did fantastic on probation. She was compliant. She did not violate at all. She successfully completed everything. At our last meeting, she said, my goal now is to get a job and an apartment so that I can be independent of my ex-boyfriend and that I can be safe with my child. I believe it was approximately 1 year later, she called me to report that she was denied housing, and she was extremely upset and felt, you know, as if, as I described before, as the examples. She is now 24, and I wonder if she ever got housing and if she ever got free of this relationship. The last example I want to give is regarding a young man named John. He was pulled over for a minor traffic violation, and in the course of the police officer searching the car, he was found what was thought to be amphetamines. John was charged with a felony possession of controlled substance. He had the resources for private counsel. The substance was sent to the BCA, which in fact came back negative for any controlled substance, resulting in a dismissal of the case. Down the road, he applied for college housing in the college of his choice. Unfortunately, the record showed up as a felony on his record. Although it was dismissed, it was still on his record. Ultimately, it prevented him from going to this college. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nichols. Representative Smith, anyone else to testify on this bill? Sir, please come forward. Good morning. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Derek Madsen. I'm the program executive for the YMCA of the Greater Twin Cities. I oversee our Youth Intervention Services Department. Last year, the YMCA served over 1,800 such youth in our community. We serve youth who are facing homelessness, involved in the juvenile justice system, demonstrating truant behavior, and we match them with caring adult YMCA staff who aim to increase their self-sufficiency and advocate for them and teach them how to advocate for themselves to become independent, self-sufficient members of our community. We are in support of this bill as it would reduce one of many barriers that our youth face as they try to create successful lives for themselves. Only 51% of the youth that we worked with last year were able to attain employment. And the reality is they were working very closely with YMCA staff. We attribute the fact that information is shared on their records with employers, with housing agencies, as the main barrier that's preventing them from receiving employment. I have one brief story, and I'll keep it brief in the interest of time. We worked with a 16-year-old male. He came to us at 17. At 16, he had committed a nonviolent felony offense. He was charged. He was placed in a residential facility. Upon reentering the community, this young man began working with his YMCA staff and really began to turn his life around. He made up the credits that he needed to get on track with his education and will graduate on time. He changed his set of friends. He began engaging in pro-social activities. He came to the Y, played basketball. He really recognized the mistake that he had made and turned his life around. When this young man began searching for employment, he would be able to get in the door. He had the skills needed to interview effectively, to get access to employers. But when it came to the point in time that they would run his background check, he would get turned away from these jobs because the charge of the felony offense would come up on his record. The reality is this young man now has lost a lot of hope for his future. He's 18 years old, and he doesn't necessarily understand why all the work that he's done to this point is being disregarded. We have to do a lot of work to educate employers on what these records are actually showing and what type of information is actually being shared, because most employers don't understand how to interpret these records as they're being shown to them. And so we see it continually and repeatedly negatively affecting our young people. That's all I have. And I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
I don't believe we have any more testimony.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, no further questions before the committee. Representative Smith, would you like to renew your motion?
I would, and in the process of doing that, I'd like to thank you, Chairman Szymanski, and also other co-authors on the bill on this committee, Representatives Johnson, Gilstrom, Champion, Liebling, and Lesh. And I'd renew my motion that the bill be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
And that bill would be, the motion would be to the bill as amended, correct, Representative
yes,
Smith? All right. Any further discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of passage of House File 876, say aye.
Aye.
As amended, pardon me. All those opposed, say nay. The bill is passed. Representative Smith, would you like to introduce your next bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 2623 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. There is an amendment.
All right. Representative Smith, would you like to move your amendment?
I'll move A3 to get the bill in the shape of heat, and then I may have an opening remark, and then I'll let the testifier take it from there. So I move the A3 amendment.
All right. We have the A3 amendment to House File 2623. Any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of adopting the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, what this bill does is it extends the time from two 90-day periods to two 180-day periods in which a judge may continue a case dealing with adjudication of youth when in the best interest of the child, in order for the juvenile to complete whatever tasks may be assigned. That's pretty loose, but I'll let the testifier take it.
Good morning, sir. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Szymanski, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Hagstrom. I'm a probation officer in Chisago County, where I've been a probation officer for 19 years. This bill came out of discussions with MCA, MACAC, a number of other professional corrections organizations dealing directly with juvenile corrections. Juvenile probation officers often find themselves in a position of just not having enough time to work with some of the juveniles that we have to work with. Less serious, lower risk juveniles with less serious offenses find themselves in a bind often with the limitations of a 6-month period of time in which to work with, dealing with insurance issues, family other issues, often eats up most of the first 90-day continuance before we can even get them into appropriate programming. Many of these youth also have needs that are for multiple programs, chemical dependency treatment or drug abuse treatment, mental health programming, other programming that stretches out often beyond the 6 months. And quite honestly, yes, some of them drag their feet. They're kids. They make dumb mistakes. Current law goes back to about 1994, before, I can't tell which, when these we were given the opportunity to continue these cases for these kids so that they could be given time to get some programming done. We could get them out of the system without the record of a delinquency, which, as in the previous bill you've all heard, can have real serious consequences for them later on in life. Under a continuance, these juveniles have the option of doing out-of-home placements on a voluntary basis. They can go into an inpatient treatment program. They can go into other foster care facilities on a voluntary basis. There's nothing in statute that prevents the probation department working with these kids and their families to get them into residential programming if that's what's necessary. But it's done on a voluntary basis. The hook, of course, with that is that you either do it or you're going to end up with a delinquency on your record. So we use that as leverage. In these cases, they have to follow through with the court's orders. The courts have the ability to order these juveniles to do certain programming. They don't have the ability to court order them into residential programming involuntarily. They do have the ability to court order these youth into a myriad of outpatient treatment programs, mental health, chemical dependency, sex offender treatment programs. They run the gamut. This is a tool for the probation departments, for the juvenile justice system, to work with these kids to give them more time to get these programs done. At any point in time, if that youth fails badly enough, the prosecutor can motion the court or petition the court for a hearing and move for the delinquency. There would be a review hearing at the end of the first continuance if it's found that the youth is not performing well or is being recalcitrant. They can certainly move for delinquency at that point. Delinquency findings for these youth can have serious long-term consequences. Recently, student was not allowed admission into seminary because he had a disorderly conduct when he was about 15 years old, and for whatever reason, he didn't get whatever programming that was required of him done in a timely manner, ended up with a delinquency on his record. Now, this is a kid that did what he was ordered to do, he was responsible, he took care of business, maybe not within the time that he was given, but later on in life, he's going to move in a very positive direction and was denied admission into seminary. One of our judges likes to tell the story of the of a young man who finished high school, went on to college, probably a 2-year program, got his degree to be a pharmacy tech. When they did the background check, when he went to get licensed as a pharmacy tech, he was denied because he had a delinquency on his record because of a possession of paraphernalia. You might say that these kids should have known better, but they're kids. Kids make dumb mistakes. We're looking for a little more time to do the work we need to do with these kids so that a percentage of these kids don't have consequences later on in life that are going to bar them from housing, jobs, and other opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative Smith, another testifier?
I believe we do. I want to thank the representative from the county probation officers who just delivered testimony that they are not dragging their feet. They're just roadblocks to getting the job done. And that's the purpose for this.
Okay. Good morning, and please identify yourself once more for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jackie Nichols, juvenile probation officer representing MCA Juvenile Justice Committee. For the sake of time, I won't repeat what the previous testifier said. But in short, I want to give you an example of a young man and the reason why we need more time to reduce the risk of these kids and not have them come back on probation later on, which would be also inefficient in the system. Again, a young man who he got in a fight with a peer at school. He was charged with a felony assault because there was an injury to the other person's nose. This was a school fight. He had a number of things to do while on probation, including paying restitution for this other kid's medical bills. We needed time for him to get a job. We needed time for him to pay back the victim, and we came upon 6 months of probate, 6 months of the stay, the maximum stay as it currently is in law. And he was restitution was not yet paid in full. He was compliant. He was following a payment schedule. He had no probation violations. Another thing this young man was doing was participating in family and individual counseling. Again, they were making progress. He was engaged. He was compliant. However, his risk wasn't adequately reduced because of family issues and a number of other things. At that time, at the six-month mark, when the court was losing jurisdiction, my concern was, we're not done yet. We're not done to be confident that we're not going to see this young man return into the system. In summary, we simply cannot address long-term change in 6 months.
We must have more time to utilize scientifically proven measures to reduce recidivism long term. The more latitude we can give the courts on higher risk juveniles, we can increase both long and short term public safety. Longer time frames more adequately address the underlying issues that lead to criminal behavior. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Smith, one more testifier.
We have one more, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the Executive Director and Legislative Liaison for MACACT, the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. The 32 counties that I represent supervise about 70% of the juveniles in the juvenile justice system in Minnesota. And we worked over many years with MACPO and MCA on this proposal. It's something we've jointly endorsed for many years. I did just want to make a couple of comments, particularly to the amendment, explain what that does a little bit. Currently, under statute, when a judge grants a continuance like this, subdivision 1 of statute 260B198, clauses 1 and 2 are the only dispositional options available to the court. And those two dispositional options are relatively basic, provide the court limited supervision. If you read that statute and get further down, you'll find things like restitution, ordering to treatment, requiring that this juvenile stay in school are dispositional options listed later in the statute. What the clause does, what the amendment does, is not just limit it to clause 1 and 2, but open the entire subdivision with the exception of clauses 3 and 4. And Mr. Hagstrom referenced those. That is the involuntary out-of-home placement and the commitment to the Commissioner of Corrections. We do view those as some higher-end interventions that really are for folks that are probably further into the system and shouldn't be in the stay or continuance situation to begin with. But it is important, particularly if we do have the year of time, the 280-day continuances, as Ms. Nichols referenced, in terms of helping find jobs and pay restitution, that we have some of those additional dispositional options available to us. Some feedback from the county attorneys helped us arrive at that conclusion, and we're supportive of that amendment. So with that, the professionals in the field behind me have already given you the great examples of why this is an important bill, so I won't take any more of your time. But again, MACACT has worked jointly, and we do appreciate your time and consideration to this bill.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Chairman, I have no other testifiers.
Representative Smith, okay. No other testifiers. Any questions from committee members? Oh, pardon me. Come on up. We will take testimony from anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill. So welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I hope I didn't jump in too quickly.
No.
My name is Janet Ryder. I'm the Chisago County Attorney. I'm chair of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee. The Juvenile Law Committee has discussed this proposed bill extensively, and I'm here to lodge our opposition to the bill on behalf of the Juvenile Law Committee. The amendment, which Mr. Erdman just discussed, does move the Juvenile Law Committee somewhat closer to the side of the other people who have testified in the proponent of the bill. However, we still have some serious concerns about it. I think it's very important to recognize what this is. A stay of adjudication is a tool used by prosecutors in the courts when juveniles are alleged to have committed delinquency-level offenses. For the most part, it's assaultive behavior, it's gross misdemeanors, and felony-level offenses. These are not minor offenses for which we should brush under the rug. The system has diversion programs for youth. The system treats juvenile petty offenders with a large amount of leniency. This is a stay of adjudication on a delinquency level offense. And I think it's important to draw back and recognize what the stated goal of the juvenile justice system is by statute. Everyone who has testified thus far has talked about the rehabilitative goals of the juvenile justice system. What the statute does say that the goal is to promote public safety and reduce delinquency by maintaining the integrity of this substantive law, prohibiting certain behavior, and by developing individual responsibility for lawful behavior. That's the stated goal of the juvenile justice system, individual responsibility for lawful behavior. The time frames that we have in place right now, the Juvenile Law Committee thinks is sufficient. A stay of adjudication is for low-risk youth who have needs for intervention that can be accomplished within that initial 290-day periods. These are for juveniles and their families who are highly motivated to keep these matters off their records. That is the goal of what prosecutors view a stay of adjudication as. By expanding that to up to 280-day periods, a full year, what we end up with is a larger number of youth under supervision of probation, where they are working kids through the system, fighting with families, hesitance to engage in therapy or treatment. Certainly there's obstacles, but this tool is specifically geared towards low-risk youth, not juveniles who need a greater expansive amount of interventions. So that is first and foremost our interpretation of what a stay of adjudication is and why we believe this bill is not necessary. Another significant factor is that when a court imposes a stay of adjudication, it's deemed an interim order from which a county attorney cannot appeal, meaning it's not a final order on the case. So while the probation officers are working with a family trying to steer a child in the right direction, and a county attorney believes that adjudication is appropriate and we need to move forward with adjudication because this is a serious offense, a child with serious behaviors, we need it adjudicated for public safety, we can't appeal that decision if a court disagrees with us. That is per the rules of juvenile delinquency procedure. So even by combining these two things, opening the door and then limiting the options of a prosecutor, we simply don't have the tools that we need to protect public safety. And finally, I think it's important to note that while we hear the stories of juveniles who seemingly have minor offenses, whose doors are closed for their futures, we get that, we understand that, but this bill would appear to be a band-aid effect for what is really needs to be addressed in a greater schematic view of the juvenile justice system to develop some policies and protocols for the collateral consequences. What we're talking about is those limits for jobs and employment and education, and those things, those are collateral consequences which other laws have imposed on the juveniles, and the access to data has imposed on the juveniles. We believe that a stay of adjudication should be limited to the 290-day periods so that within 6 months, a child has done his job, gotten it back on the track, or we adjudicate. It's important to notice where our colleagues in the correctional field have said, we just need more time. The option there is adjudication. That means we have a family whose youth are not taking the programming seriously. They're not turning their life around. We haven't accomplished the goals that we set out to do, so adjudication is the right option. Then we have limited amount of time to work with these youth and these families. So those are the three things that I want the committee to really to take with us, is that the juvenile justice system is geared towards public safety, stay of adjudication is geared towards low-risk offenders, and by opening this door, it really waters down and dilutes that process. And thirdly, collateral consequences are a real and significant issue, but it needs to be re-examined and looked at in a broader approach. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question from Representative Liebling. Is it for this witness, Representative Liebling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it seems to me that some of what you're arguing, I think, certainly has merit, but it seems to me that these are arguments that if this bill would pass in any individual case, the prosecutor could make these arguments to the judge that this isn't a case that merits an expanded period of stay and that a delinquency finding is appropriate and that the family just isn't doing what it should do and so on. And so it really seems to me that what this bill would be doing is simply giving more discretion to the judge as opposed to the prosecutor. Isn't that true? I mean, from my experience in the justice system, not so much the juvenile justice system, but the justice system altogether, it's really about, when you squeeze the balloon, when you take authority away from somebody, you're giving it to somebody else. It's kind of an issue of who gets to decide. Ultimately, who's the decider? And correct me if I'm wrong, but what I hear you saying is the judge shouldn't be able to decide. But it seems to me that if we pass this bill, if this is enacted, it doesn't stop prosecutors from making that argument and having that argument accepted in any individual case. Isn't that correct?
Ms. Ryder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, our position is that by expanding this window and putting it back into the judge's hands, we are putting it in the judge's hands, but there's two issues that the Juvenile Law Committee finds problematic with that, is that it doesn't promote consistency and uniformity across the state. We know that what goes on in our different 87 counties is lacks a consistency. By broadening this, it will simply exacerbate that issue. And secondly, the other issue is that the rules of juvenile delinquency prohibit a county attorney from appealing that judge's order. And that really is another significant barrier to the uniformity and the consistency in protecting public safety. When a prosecutor is prohibited from appealing this interim order, it really doesn't allow us the equal playing field as the defense counsel or to make known our objections to a judge's decision. We're tied. Our hands are tied.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and that's kind of exactly what sort of raised that flag for me, is the issue about the appeal, because really the core of that argument is we don't get to decide anymore, only the judge does. But I think that you can still make your argument. Nobody's stopping county attorneys from making the argument, and indeed they should make the argument if they have one in an individual case. But this question about who should decide, you know, I think we hire and pay our judges to be the deciders in individual cases. And so, you know, I hear you, but I just don't buy that, because I think the function of the county attorney, the good, proper function, is to make those arguments to the judge in the individual case. But I frankly think that in these kinds of cases where individual issues come in and the collateral consequences do come in and weigh in on the ultimate public safety aspects, as some of the testifiers were talking about, those issues need to be weighed by the judge, who is the person who's hired to make those kinds of decisions.
Ms. Ryder?
With all due respect, I acknowledge that the judges do make those tough calls every day. I think that our concern is that to protect public safety, we are looking for juveniles to be adjudicated, for this information to be in the right cases made available. We recognize every day that while we know of these relatively good youth who make poor decisions while they're young, there are equal number of youth who struggle with their behaviors, their antisocial behaviors, well into an adulthood, and there is a public safety benefit to having juveniles adjudicated if they cannot complete their programming within that 60-day, that first 6 months.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ryder. If I may ask a question, you'd indicated that in prosecuting a youthful offender of a serious crime, is there such thing as, do they plead to a lesser charge in some circumstances, and then even though they may have committed a more serious crime, are they adjudicated on a lesser charge?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the juvenile justice system, I believe for the most part, and I can't speak for every jurisdiction throughout this state, the goal is to maintain the integrity of the substantive law. So juvenile crimes are equally difficult to prove in some cases as adult crime. So we're, in every case that's presented to a county attorney, we're looking to whether or not we can prove the delinquent offense. And if it's a second-degree assault with a weapon and we feel that we can't prove that felony-level second-degree assault with a weapon, it may be pled down to a fifth-degree assault. There may be instances where amount of drugs are found, and if we're not able to get the test, it may be pled down to some other offense. But in any case, we're looking to uphold the substantive integrity of the Minnesota law. That is the goal. It's to use the same statutes that govern the behaviors of our adults in the juvenile system, and then, one, implement the programming that's available through our probation officers, and modify and intervene and mend and change these juveniles' behaviors before they reach adulthood. And our thoughts on the staying of this adjudication is to do that within that 6 months.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions for this witness or any other testifiers on this bill? Well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Smith, would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would. And I would just like to add a footnote that this bill, like the preceding one, was brought to me and therefore to you by the probation officers in the state of Minnesota. I believe Minnesota has the, not everyone can be put into jail, Mr. Chairman, and I believe that Minnesota up until very recently was the lowest number of incarcerations per capita in the United States. We're now second lowest. I think Hawaii is lower than us. We're also, I believe, the highest number of probation, people on probation per capita in the United States. So the probation officers of the state of Minnesota brought us this bill and the bill prior to this one, saying they need this in order to monitor the folks on probation. The contents of the file indicate there have been at least two amendments proposed. The probation officers have worked, and their association has worked with the County Attorney's Association. They've gone a long way to meet their concerns. And yes, the two things that need to be done in this state when it comes to juvenile court is, number one, hold the individual accountable, thus addressing public safety, and secondly, doing so without ruining their life. So I would renew my motion that this bill be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the General Register, House File 2623 as amended.
All right. Thank you, Representative Smith. The motion is before us. Seeing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of House File 2623 as amended, be recommended to pass and send to the General Register, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next bill on our agenda today is House File 749. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I've just been given a cue card, so
While you're organizing those, Representative Smith, I understand we also have a DE-4 amendment. Is that correct?
We do, and that's what my cue card here is going to address. I think I have an oral amendment to the DE-4, which I think we should handle first. That would be line 2.2.
All right. Representative Smith, would you like to move the bill to put it before the committee?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 749 be recommended to pass, be sent to the General Register, and in the process of doing that, I'd like to offer the DE-4 amendment with the proposed oral amendment to line 2.2 that the year number 2011 be deleted and insert the year 2012.
Okay.
Because it's 2012 now and no longer 2000.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Any discussion to the oral amendment to the DE-4 amendment? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. All in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. That amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, to the DE-4 amendment.
Get the bill in shape, I'd like to move the DE-4 as amended and then proceed with that.
All right. Representative Smith moves the DE-4 amendment. Any discussion before we take testimony on adopting this amendment? All right. Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the DE-4 amendment as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The DE-4 amendment is before us.
Mr. Chairman, House File 749 as amended can be referred to as the Family Reunification Act. And I'm going to go right to my testifier, Mr. Elwood, and let him explain what we're trying to do here.
Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. First of all, I want to thank Representative Smith for carrying the bill and the co-authors on this committee, Representatives Vogel, Swiedzinski, Wardlow, Lesch, and Champion. Also like to thank the chair for hearing the bill and Mr. Blodgett for his help this session, and Ms. Perius for her work on the amendment, the DE4, kind of last minute. And finally, I'd like to thank John Kingrey and the County Attorneys Association. You're going to hear from them in opposition to this bill, but we have been in discussions, and as you know, Mr. Kingrey is always very gracious, and just want to appreciate his help in trying to work with us on this bill. Mr. Chair, members, there are about 1,200 children in foster care, and many are never adopted. This bill gives a limited right to petition the court for reinstatement of parental rights once they've been terminated. The bill is very narrowly crafted. The amendment before you, or that you've adopted, actually reflects changes that were made in or proposed in civil law last year when the bill was heard to make it even tighter and make it even more narrowly crafted. It sets up an extraordinarily high bar to succeed on a petition. Every element of proof needs to be proven by clear and convincing evidence. There are many, many hoops to jump through. There are an additional hurdle that this DE4 amendment puts in that civil law had requested. This was a Representative Holberg. It's requiring a preliminary hearing at which a prima facie showing of fitness, that the home is safe, and that the conditions that led to the termination have been corrected would have to take place before going any further. There would be reports required from the guardian ad litem and the social service agency. There would be a notice and opportunity for all interested parties to be present and be heard. The process is set up so that in lieu of the periodic review of the case, this petition would be heard, the preliminary hearing would be heard, and then that would be held, and then if they make it through that hurdle, then the next hearing would take place during the regularly scheduled review process. There are additional safeguards so that only folks who have truly cleaned up their lives and who are fit to be parents once again and have a reunite that family. No one terminated for sexual or physical abuse could even ask. No one terminated for any conviction of any of the numerous egregious harm standards that we have in statute could even ask. There are 9 other states that have similar statutes. We have heard of no problems that have arisen as a result of those statutes. The state with perhaps the most mature law in this area that we know of is Washington State. And that state, in most states, there are really maybe 10 to 15 petitions a year. This will not create a floodgate. There will not be thousands of petitions. But for those folks who, this is really geared to, think about a teen parent who made a dumb mistake when he or she was young, 16, 17, 18, 16, 17, 18, 8, 10 years have gone by, she's 28, the child is 10, and she is now remarried or married, has kids of her own with a new family, and the child that she had back when and whose rights and the rights were terminated from that child is now in foster care. And this bill would allow either the child or the parent
or if it was an Indian tribe or the Social Service Agency, to ask the court to bring that family back together under a clear and convincing evidentiary standard. This bill is supported by 20 organizations, and they include the Children's Law Center, Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota, the Ramsey County Human Services and Public Health Department, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, the Minnesota Council for Child Caring Agencies, the Minnesota Fathers and Families Network, the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office, the Juvenile Division, and the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which represents 53 organizations. I don't see Ms. Walker here. She was supposed to be here to testify. I guess she has a conflict. But I think what she would tell you is, from her organization's standpoint, there are folks who have been incarcerated and who have cleaned up their lives, and both dads and moms who could potentially benefit by having a second chance under this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a long line of questions. Mr. Chair, I'm opposed to this bill.
Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Representative Smith. So can you tell me when this petition takes place? Who pays for the lawyer who is going to be doing the petition? And when we terminate parental rights, the public defenders used to or still represent the children if they're under 10, and now the county pays for the parent's lawyer upon termination. So when this new process starts, who pays for those lawyers?
Representative, or Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that would be up to the petitioner.
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the county or the social services or the social worker can petition as well. So then whoever the government entity is would then pay for that lawyer?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, if the social service agency was the petitioner, then it would, yeah, that's correct.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does the kid get the lawyer again in this process, and is that the public defender, or does just the person petitioning get a lawyer in this process?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I believe that the child would still be would have a guardian ad litem. The bill does not say that the child gets an attorney.
Mr. Chair.
Representative exactly. Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Elwood, children do get a lawyer if they're under 10 through the process of termination. One would think that you would want to be consistent in the reunification process. So, Mr. Elwood, can you tell me how long after termination does a parent have to wait before they could petition to have their rights reinstated?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I believe the bill provides a 36-month waiting period.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many times can a petitioner petition to have their rights reinstated if they have had their rights terminated and are attempting to reunify?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I believe there would be an additional two-year waiting period after a denial for a parent to petition, but there is a provision that the petition can't go forward if the child doesn't agree.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how will they find out if the child agrees? What's the process to determine that if the child doesn't have a lawyer?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, there is a process that the court can, first of all, guardian ad litem would be available for the child, and second of all, there is a provision where the judge can speak with the child outside of the courtroom proceedings.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there a fiscal note on this bill?
Representative Smith.
I'm sorry, repeat.
Is there a fiscal note on this bill?
I have one in my file, I believe.
All right. I have a fiscal note in my file. I believe it's completed 425.11. Has there been any update subsequent to the DE-4 amendment?
I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Further questions, Representative Hillstrom?
Just a statement, Mr. Chair. I've had a number of conversations with Mr. Elwood over the years on this provision. Members, many of you don't know this, but I took in a child who was not related to me, and he lived with me for 5 years. And ultimately, these kids want to be back with their families. And I believe this bill gives false hope. While you may successfully reunify a few children, what you do is tell every single child in the system, guess what, someday your parent might come back and be able to reunify with you. And that's not going to happen in the majority of cases. I think this bill is way too broad. I even had some discussions that maybe if the child was over 16, I might be able to support the proposal. But ultimately what's happening is you're going to hold these kids, and they're going to think their families are coming back for them. And in the majority of cases, they're not ever coming back. So I would encourage members to vote no.
Any further comments? Questions on the bill? The Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that raises a question for me. You know, thank you for that, Representative Hillstrom, but I think that's a serious issue, but it raises a question for me. How is a child going to know about this? Mr. Elwood, how are the kids going to know? I mean, we often talk here about, or I often say, you know, does putting something in law deter, you know, if we up a sentence, how do people know? Do they think about the statute book? In this kind of case, are the children going to know that there's a possibility, or who would tell them?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't think most children would know that if there's a law, but more importantly, at least from the organizations that support the bill and we've spoken with, the reality is, as far as we know, and from our youth law project at Legal Aid, kids always want to go back to their parents with or without this law. In fact, they do right now, and there is no law. And so it's, while I have the utmost respect for Representative Hillstrom and her position and her views, I think that the situation today is that kids think they're going to get back with their parents. So I don't think, with all due respect, that it will create the consequences. As far as we know, there has been no evidence that that has happened in any of the other states where this bill is, where this law is in effect. So that's my response.
Representative Liebling.
So thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Mr. Elwood. So it seems to me that right now, kids may think and wish and hope for that to happen, but it absolutely can't happen, and the parent has no incentive to even try, because for them it can't happen either, right? So maybe what this bill does is make that hope a possibility, and for the parent, perhaps it gives some incentive to work toward the day when that might be possible, because certainly for many parents, even though, you know, termination of parental rights is absolutely what should happen, for many parents, that's a devastating thing, too.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that's absolutely correct. And, you know, in addition, the fact that parents can work towards, their, you know, parents who have their rights terminated, some of them continue to have relationships with those terminated children. I mean, it's not as if they don't ever see them again. And in fact, the contemplation is that the bill, the petitions would be brought primarily in those situations where there had been continuing and ongoing relationships. Otherwise, how would they be ever able to prove by clear and convincing evidence that it's in the best interest of the child if they haven't seen their kid for 10 years? I don't think they could even begin to meet that standard. So, I mean, almost by definition, there would have to have been an ongoing relationship, which is loving and safe, and as I say before, this is really very limited in terms of its impact. There will not be hundreds and hundreds of petitions. This will be very narrowly tailored for those folks who really have changed, cleaned up their lives, have had ongoing relationships with the children. And by the way, again, I want to emphasize, the primary determinant is best interests of the child by clear and convincing evidence.
All right. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question. I want to make a comment. I understand the concern. I mean, the children. I think we need to recognize that this occurs outside of the legal system all the time. I mean, for families often step up and take care of their teenage kids, children, or young or adult. Their adult children's kids for a period of time because their parents are incapable of taking care of them, and I don't think we terminate parental rights, and so I come from a little different perspective because within culturally we don't terminate parental rights to begin with, so I mean and I realize that in this. Dominant, that occurs, and there's good reason for that, but because we don't in our culture we had support systems, extended family, community that would, for example, my sister, in our culture is a mother to my children, and I am a mother to her children, and her grandchildren call me grandma, and my grandchildren call her grandma. So if anything were to happen to one of us, the other one would step in. And so we don't terminate parental rights, and I think children. I think we have to give children more credit in that they go through trauma regardless when they lose the parent, when the parent is unable to take care of them, and I don't think you ever really get beyond that, and that the child will have to deal with that at some point. But if a parent, this is providing a legal avenue. For those cases where it's not a family, where that child's actually in foster system, and there is where a parent, and I think it happens, it doesn't happen that often, where a parent all of a sudden within the first 18 years where they become stable enough to take care of the child, but oftentimes they still have a relationship. But in those cases where there is truly a transformation in somebody's life, this provides a legal avenue, and so if we don't provide that, that child is going to not have that opportunity. That parent's not going to have that opportunity until much later, until the child's an adult can make their own decisions. So I think we're gonna miss an opportunity for because I strongly believe that a child. There's no substitute for the parent. If the parent is able, they'll want to just reestablish that relationship, and this just gives a legal avenue to do that. And as far as I think, I know my sister takes care of, has two children that were her parents. The child's parents, both of them died from alcoholism. They were probably in their 30s. And both children knew would see their parents, whether they were out of prison for a brief period of time, they were sober, or the mother was sober for a brief period of time. So they knew from a very young age that that their parent was out there. And but they, I think we have to give them more credit that they know that it's probably not going to happen. And they see it. Even if you provide a means for them to have contact with a parent, they are not going to want to go and reconcile with that parent unless they see evidence that that parent can provide a safe, stable environment. They won't do it. And so I think this provides safe way of assessing that, whether it's in the best interest of the child, whether the child is willing to go through this. It just provides a structure to do that, because you know, we managed to do it outside of the legal system, and I think it, for a lot of families, it works and it is working. But this is something that's missing, and I think it's been missing for a long time, and it's really harmed a number of children who see that their parents have recovered either from addiction, or that they've now stable employment, or they've dealt with mental health issues, and then they want to be with them, but there's no legal avenue for them to do that. So I'm in favor of this bill.
Any further comments? Do we have other testifiers here that would like to testify for or against House File 749 as amended?
Good morning.
Good morning. Please introduce yourself once more.
Janet Ryder, Chisago County Attorney. I'm here also as the chair of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee. This bill has been discussed at numerous meetings. We've discussed the pros and cons of this bill. And as it's written, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association simply opposes it as just a bad approach to addressing an issue that we see that exists out there, but this bill just simply is not the direction that we feel the policy should go in this case. Backing up, we recognize that Minnesota permanency laws are dictated by federal statute. So it is federal law that was passed in the 1990s that mandates permanency for children. Prior to that, children were in long-term foster care for years on end. The permanency laws that were advanced by the federal government and adopted by Minnesota in 1999 require that we look for a permanent home for children. And the reason that that's so critical is that children need consistency. They need to know where they're going to be. They need that stability. So what this law does is open the door for children all over the state for whom we work hard to provide a permanent, stable home. When the question was raised, how would children know, whether or not their parents are out there, or what the situation with their parents? Under this bill, if this were enacted, attorneys for parents and attorneys for children would be forthcoming with their clients and say, there is this provision that allows your parent to come back and adopt you in X number of years. That does not provide for permanency for children. It puts them in a permanent state of turmoil or chaos or emotional strife such that their ability to attach to any new prospective adoptive home is removed from the table. So we have very significant concerns for that. I will acknowledge that the Minnesota County Attorneys Association did propose a very limited amendment that would allow only local social services agencies and county attorneys to be the petitioners in these cases. That would limit the amount of litigation that would come as a result of this bill. The whole question about whether or not parents have turned their lives around, whether or not they've addressed the issues which have caused the termination, will need local social services agencies to investigate. It will require resources for which just years earlier we have worked diligently to terminate the parental rights, and now they're reexamining the same family, the same set of circumstances to determine whether or not they've turned that life around. Then if anyone is allowed to petition, the burden, both the financial and resource burden, will be on local county social services agencies and county attorney's offices. Whether or not it's granted, whether or not they meet the clear and convincing evidence threshold, will be litigated in court and will fall on the desks of county attorneys across the state. So as it's written, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association very much opposes this bill. There would be just a very limited option where we would be able to agree to it, but I don't see that amendment has been brought before the committee. So with that, I would close my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question from Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I don't see how this would lead to litigation. I mean, you have an individual who, at one point, it was so serious that their parental rights are terminated. And so there's clear documentation there. I mean, there's going to be a history there. And then in order for somebody to completely transform their lives would require intervention at some point. Likely they would maybe be on probation. They had gone to treatment. They may have gone to a diversion program. They may have been, I'm sure that, you know, that from the moment they decided that they were going to take steps to become a fit parent, that they went to either parenting classes or that they went. So I think there's going to be a long history of those 2 years or 36 months where they have taken made great efforts to transform their lives. And so I think the social services, the courts, law enforcement, mental health. They're going to have to present all of that in order to show that they have really transformed those. So I don't see how this is really going to be litigated. It'll already be well documented prior to that. Would you disagree with that,
Ms. Rager?
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, there always remains the question of have they address their chemical dependency issues. Have they reached a position in their life where they're able to financially care for a child and provide them with stability? It's always going to be a question of best interests of the children. And so in our criminal justice system, we see people who recidivate all the time. In our juvenile justice system, our child protection system, we've worked diligently with that parent 1 full year prior to terminating that parent's parental rights. Efforts have been made. Services have been offered. Those have been futile. And just to terminate parental rights, it's a determination by the court that for the reasonably foreseeable future, this parent will be unable to parent that child. So even after a length of time, if additional services have been offered, it still takes resources to document and verify and then address whether or not that person has really turned their life around. And if anybody opposes or contests that, perhaps it's another father, perhaps it's a guardian ad litem who opposes reunification, it's going to require a hearing, the presentation of evidence. It can take literally days in a court's docket to address these matters. I don't know that it's going to be something that's going to be determined within a one-hour hearing.
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, I can't imagine how much foster care would cost over the life of that child if you keep them in foster care. A short period of time where you may expend some resources and you're able to reunify a child with the parent, and the child is able to care for that child, because I'm assuming that that's probably going to be a factor whether they can adequately, you know, take care of the child. And so we remove a child. It would be likely in these cases, because they'd have to be very strong cases, that the child's going to then be no longer part of the system and a ward or of the state, that the state's not long after provide child care, or they're not going to be in a family where, you know, hopefully that welfare or public assistance won't be required. Or so I don't see how it you know, I think it would save in the long run, it would actually save the state a lot of money.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Allen, our position really, when we're talking about the cost of long-term foster care, that is a cost in caring for these children. We're really concerned about the best interests of the children, and so I would go back to what I had said previously, that it's not necessarily the cost. It's really about permanency for children, their best interests, whether or not they can be in a safe, permanent home. And so I recognize that there's going to be a cost on either side of the equation, but ultimately it's the best interest that whatever comes out of this bill, it needs to focus on ensuring that children's needs are being met.
Great. Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I'd renew my motion that House File 749, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Okay, you've heard the motion before us. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor of the the bill as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The bill is passed. All right. That concludes our agenda for this morning. Our next committee meeting will be Thursday morning, March 22nd, 8:15 a.m. We are adjourned.